read some from Plum Creek Odyssey, which is this book, and some from Voyages, which is this one, and then maybe a few new ones that I've not read before. Okay, I wish you could see the illustrations in this particular one. They're very good illustrations. And I want to start with a trilogy called The Auction, The Home, and the Auction, The Home, and The Death. And in this illustration shows a bunch of people. I don't know why I should do that. You can't possibly see. I had a C in audio visual from Pepperdine University because I used to go like that, and the professor would say, no, don't go like that, especially when you're 20 feet away. And I could never string a bell and howl, so I was barely got out of the C in that class. But these illustrations show the people mucking about at this auction, picking up things. You've all been to auctions, so you know what that's like. You want something because it's cheap, something that looks nice on your mantle or somewhere. So when I lived in Nebraska, I taught at a small college there for a while. I went to a lot of auctions, and Seward, Concordia Seward. Did you go there?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
When?
Oh, I don't know. My wheels can't. Math wasn't my major. Oh. I think I graduated December
74. 74. I was there from 74 to 74. Oh, I was there 64 to 66. Seems like yesterday, but to me. Anyway. At Concordia Seward?
Uh-huh.
It's a nice town, nice college.
I don't think they were 16.
Well, they were, I had a year, though.
At any rate, I'm going to start with these three poems, and it talks about the auction. And Harry and Gladys are just in time to hear this poem that they've heard a million times. I remember this.
I did. I'll go get it.
No, sir.
I'll go get it.
No, later. I'll walk out on my phone.
Well, if it were anything but the auction, I would.
Anyway, I finally stopped going to auctions because it was got to be a bit much walking around, always trying to find something that I wanted for 25 cents. And just because it would look neat in my home in Southern California, when it was obvious, painfully obvious, to the people who lived there and had all these possessions all their lives, they had to sell them, they had to auction them so they could go to Sun City, Florida, or Retirement Village, California, wherever they went. They couldn't take all this stuff with them, so they had to sell it, and then they sold the house. But it didn't make it any easier, because I knew these possessions meant something to them, whereas to me it was just a kind of grubbing around. And finally, I couldn't do that anymore, so I stopped going to auctions altogether. So it led to three poems, Auction and the Home and the Death. So I'll start with the auction. The throat stays open. I think it's the telyx. I've discovered that. I've come to that conclusion. I think it is. Remember Mary Henderly. Breathe because of the trailing dust. All right. This is the auction. He started at the rear of the house with the tools, while the ladies gathered near the front porch to sift through the personal things. All around the house, the furniture had been arranged, and after seeing the naked, shamed inside, which they had sat in for years, the older women found rockers in the front to sit in, and they rocked easily. The men showed up for the tools. Standing close to the wooden benches and tables, they looked a convention of train men in their striped coveralls and train caps. The coveralls gaped at the side, showing blue denim shirts or long underwear. Their burnt red faces screwed up into funny looks as the auctioneer approached. His one stump arm carried the black glove at a hammer angle. The men joked and looked away. They had already felt the length of the sledges or tested the bite and grip of saws and pliers, sideways glancing at him with nods, wanting the saw for 2 bits. Joking at the running words that spilled like an organized waterfall behind the frame house. The others waited with foot raised on bumpers of shiny new pickups, watching but not bidding. They come at auctions. Who's moving? What's he selling? Why, that's all right, though I got one already. As the seller of things moves around the house, the men trail off, pushing the mowers, hefting guiltily the long wrenches. Then the long line of canned goods and brown crocks, pickles watched by sharp-nosed women. and the late ones stand against the high boys stacked in front. The rocking women rock and don't complain that they can't see. The muscled man in front is buying glassware. He doesn't nod for it, but he buys the glass for his shop on the Milford Road. When the letters and scissors and beads and buttons are gone in the one box and the round German pictures for frames, the rockers go, and the old women go home to bake and to wait. Then the small boys jump through the flower beds at tag, and the station wagon lumbers over the ditch with a bed spring sticking out, and the tally sheet is figured inside on a card table that didn't sell. So there's the auction. And then, of course, after all the stuff is gone, then they auction the house. And that's when I think it was most painful, after all the stuff is gone. Then, particularly one day when I was at an auction in Friend, Nebraska. You can imagine a town called Friend, Nebraska, in this beautiful three-story house, fully replumbed, hardwood floors, two barns, a whole bunch of trees, and a little stream meandering by, and the house sold for $11,500. And being a Californian where land is $1 million an acre, I was devastated. I thought, well, this is a crime that these people are going to wherever they're going, and that's all they can get for this is $11,500. And my Irish exploded momentarily, and the guy next to me kind of jabbed me with his ribs. He said, well, what do you think of that price? I said, I think it sucks big eggs, or something to that effect. And he got a very serious look. He said, I think it's tremendous. I said, why? He says, because I just bought it. I said, oh, pardon me. Good for you. And I said, where are you from? He says, Oxnard, California. Ever heard of it? Well, it's right up the road from where I live, in Thousand Oaks. So he was a mail carrier in Oxnard, had enough of the big city, and decided to come to Friend, Nebraska, and he bought this beautiful 5 acres place for $11,500. So from his point of view, it was great. I could have wished it would have sold for the old people for $100,000, but... There's a philosophical nugget I'll leave you to chew on and get on to the next poem. This is the home. The hot morning sun sucked the shadow off the wide board porch where the old woman rocked. The bustle in the house was noisier than necessary, but she rocked the same for all of the talk that hung heavy on the August air. From her porch, she could see the ladies gather across the gravel street, their heads bonneted and bent in the trellis shade. Her long, bony hands tightened on the smooth, brown rocker arms. She shuffled her feet on the porch and lifted a yellowed handkerchief to her throat, then let it drop to her lap. The sun spun in a mazy light, white motions in the beams that struck the hot roof of the pickup that bumped the ditch and rolled to a stop at the porch. The driver smiled a wide, clean smile and said, "Ma'am," as he leaped the steps and banged through the screen door. The old lady tried to say something as he jumped the steps, but he moved too fast in the sun, his face blurred in the web of years that held her in her chair. The ladies in the shade looked up as the family started out the door, formal, like an odd parade. They marked the ties, the old blue suit, the fans, the brooch, and how they passed the chair but turned in awkward angles to look before they got in cars. The old woman rocked and rubbed one hand upon the other and felt she ought to tell them of her dresses that they folded in the truck. And the ladies on the swing cried, "Hush, and come out and see now," to others in the house across the street. The sun came up the steps, the chair rocked, but slower. And turning once, she saw the neighbor's cat lying quiet in the gladiolas, watching the soft brown birds dancing in the bird bath. And she kept looking at the cat and the birds as she was lifted from the chair, her back held firm by long, strong arms, her head against his chest, the world moving around her as she watched. And all the world there was sat quiet across the street as the trellis vine stirred slightly in the darkness of the porch. So there's that part of the trilogy. And those two poems were published in a magazine many years ago together. And then about 10 years after that, the death came back. So that sort of completes the picture, as far as I know. This is the last part of the death. She tried. They had fixed her up a room like that she'd left. They gave her sun in afternoons and allowed the fern brought by a cousin. The canary, a gift from the sun, did not live long, but still she tried. A few pictures in her album were rounded at the edges from handling. She combed her long gray hair, brushed it, set the favorite comb, and went to bed. And the first long winter passed without a mark or sign to show she'd ever been anywhere but there. Then the spring, and the hot summer, and when the trees turned yellow in the woods, she closed the door and sat on the creaking bed. She didn't cry or move at all, nor ask for dinner when they came at 5. But only passed one hand across her hair to make it neat for anyone who came. No one did. An early snow covered nearly all the ground the day they buried her. The sun stood by as forms were offered, signed, witnessed. And then they started out and left the home she had never known, past trees bare and white, past people moving slowly on the icy streets, and children's eyes looking up. So, there's that trilogy. Is it my imagination, or is it warm in here, or is it just me?
Just me,
I heard. What is that whirring here? Is that anybody know about that? Is that something?
What's what?
Is that something that has to stay on, like a fan?
I don't know. It's probably the fan on this outdoor thing.
Ah, well, we don't want to ruin it. It's cozy. Since this is a small group,
it's this bloody freezer.
Yeah, I just sit in there and read from an open door. Yeah. Since a small group, if you have any questions or comments, just stop me and interrupt. Just be real casual about this. Nothing sacred about a poetry reading. So, if you want to ask anything or say anything, just do it.
I feel rude because I came in late. Who's the author? Who's the writer?
I am.
But is somebody you know?
No. Just sort of a combination, I guess, of impressions after you go to that many auctions and see that many people. I was always impressed by Seward, Nebraska, and my hometown of Greenville, Illinois, Southern Illinois. How many elderly people I see always there. It's just a matter of course. And in Southern California, how, in some ways, how different it is. Either you don't see as many, or they have just come out of jazzercise or aerobics and hit in their portion and take off. And somehow it's a different, it jars the sensibilities a little bit. I've lived in Southern California most of my life. But I can't seem to dredge up any poems about jazzercisers and their forces yet. The poems still come from the roots in the Midwest. Well, okay.
Have you ever contemplated why?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have. I think it's not something I try to look at too closely, because I think it probably means I should be back there. And I don't, for all kinds of reasons. I'm not there, and I'm not sure. I think Thomas Wolfe is probably right. If I went back there, it might ruin it. In some ways, it has become mythic for me, and in some ways, that's more important than the literal. If you can live with that dichotomy, then, and who can? Well, we all have our dichotomies. But that's a good question. I think most people live their lives, at least I have always, trying to prove Thomas Wolfe is wrong, that you really can go home again. And I think he's right, you really can't. But I keep trying. But I do it through the poems. That's probably the safest way.
I think before you were talking about the crime of the price of the home in Oxnard, I think you should turn it around perhaps and say the crime is the price of the homes in California.
Yeah. Yeah. It sure is. That is a crime. Yeah, it's a very great crime when especially young people can't buy homes and they have to move out.
Or the elderly people who
sell, that's right.
And have
sure.
Places.
Yeah. It is silly. Land or material things should not be worth that kind of money. I agree. Okay, those were three verse, in case anybody's keeping score. And so maybe let's turn it around. I'll read something structured just for balance. It's In Winter Dreams. Those of you who have the program, it's on page 7. Winter Dreams, it's part of a three poems I wrote for Mark Van Doren, the poet who lived in Cornwall Hollow, Connecticut. And Cornwall Hollow is in the northwestern section of Connecticut. And I wrote 3 or 4 poems for him. And the Winter Dreams is the last one, and it's a sonnet, so I just read that because it's form. It's obviously the winter. Those rolling, rolling clouds of dark and light that spread themselves across the autumn night, those chilling winds that cut the tops of trees, blowing leaves and faces as they please, and coating winter water mirror bright with frosted crust that's only slightly glazed. This whistling wind that bends through branches blazed by orange, reds, and blues in drifting leaves runs heavy crested on the hill and grieves like eyes that stare open wide and dazed. These clouds and winds I see in winter dreams. They race and sing, then leaping up so high, a pale white moon is struck, or so it seems, and silver stars are scattered in the sky. So that's my...
Is this the Van Doren from Columbia?
Yes, it is. You know him?
No. But, I just finished reading a biography of Thomas Merton, and he was being a Van Doren reader. Were very close.
Which biography was it? The author?
I remember the name of it.
Yeah, Van Doren was a professor of English at Columbia for 40 years, and Merton was one of his best students. Van Doren taught Shakespeare there for all those years, and Merton had just come over from England, having made you read the biography, pretty much a mess of his life and the rest of you, and wandered into Columbia, and in the wrong classroom, he was supposed to take philosophy or medieval history or something, and he looked around, it was Shakespeare, and he was going to get up and leave, and then Mark Van Doren walked in, and he said, well, see what this guy's got to say, and that was the turning point, one of them in his life. Mark Van Doren turned out a number of students whose names you may know, Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet of the 60s, Clifton Fadiman, Lionel Trilling, great literary historian, and others, and Thomas Merton. When I was doing research on the book on Van Doren at their farm after Mark had died, I was rummaging around all his books and records, and I came across all of his grade books from Columbia University. And I sat there for an hour just looking at names like Lionel Trilling, A, all the way across the... Thomas Merton, C minus, B. It was fun to look at the grades those guys. I took heart.
Was it his son that was on that $21,000 question?
$64,000.
Cheated?
Charles Van Doren got caught up in the momentum of it all. And as you remember, the program was a huge success, and it was the first of its kind on television, or one of the first. And the mail came rolling in, and the producers of the show didn't want to see it stop, so they sort of said, Charlie, you're doing well, and you're a bright kid. He's a PhD from Columbia himself. But we hate to see it come to a close, and we're going to ask you a bunch of questions next week, and these books will probably cover the material. And Charlie couldn't help but notice that the bookmark was between page 100 and 102, so he was culpable. But he just got caught up into it. And then when it blew open in the big scandal, even had a House on American Activities, you can imagine that. Or not an American, but one of their committees. And Mark Van Doren went down to somehow testify for that, and it broke him up, and he retired from Columbia.
What happened to Charlie?
Went on, did all right for himself, became vice president of Encyclopedia Britannica, and married the secretary on the show who opened all his fan mail. And when I knew all this through reading and research, I was prepared to dislike this guy immensely. And I met him just one time and found, much to my surprise, a very engaging fellow, very nice guy. Just like anybody, there at the right time and at the right place, he just got caught up in the excitement and he went along with it, and before you know it, his bubble burst and he lost his teaching job too. I think he was teaching at Brandeis or someplace at the time. But he did all right, and Mark Van Doren has another son, John. John is editor of Great Ideas Today. They both live in Chicago, or Evanston. Okay. Anything else you want to know? I start talking about Merton again. I do this every time. What do you want me to read, Harry?
Applause.
Can I work up to it?
Yeah, you can work up.
How about Bright Spot Cafe?
Oh,
just
good. Bright Spot Cafe.
All right. I haven't read this in a long time, believe it or not. I was doing a reading tour in the Midwest years ago, and I'd read at St. Olaf, and I'd read at some other places, and I was lost somewhere between Forest City and Northfield. And I have to backtrack a little bit. When I was a kid in Southern California, my dad, home was always Illinois, back on the farm to my dad. He lived in California for 1,000 years and never got over calling Greenville home. So every Christmas and summer, we would get in an old 38 Dodge, and with the three dogs we always had in the back seat and me, and no air conditioning. And we'd set out on Highway 66 across Flyspeck, New Mexico, you know, all the way back to Illinois. My dad was a very frugal person and would never stop for motels. He always pretended he was going to stop, but he never did. About 9 o'clock at night, he'd say, "Well, it's time to put up." And I always would look up, I'd wonder what we were putting up, but I didn't understand the words, only the word. But what happened, he said, "We'll see," and he turned to my mother, whom he called Woman. He'd say, "Woman, stop here. Run in there and see if they've got any rooms for $5. Well, my mother would kind of roll her eyes, but I was too young to know. I figured she was really checking it out. Well, she was checking out to see if they had any place to sleep out. And so we would just sleep out in the gas station back behind them on the asphalt. My dad would go collapse anywhere. My mother would sleep on the seat, and they would make me a little Baptist pallet sheet on the, and with a pillow, and say, "That's it, boy." When he was woman and boy. And that's the way we, and then about 4 o'clock in the morning, my dad would be kicking me, saying, "It's time to get up, get down the line. We've got to get down the line." And I was always looking over the seat, "Where's that line?" And I'd say, "But Dad, it's, you know," I said, "What time?" He said, 4 o'clock. I said, "It's 4 o'clock. Why do you have to get down?" I never understood that. "We go to bed late, get up early, get down the line." When I had to go to the bathroom, it was really disastrous because he would not stop. I don't know what kind of kidneys and bladder he had. But mine was normal, and I'd say, "I gotta go to the bathroom," way out in the middle of New Mexico. He'd say, "Can't stop, gotta get down the line." And I'd say, after a while, I was green. I said, "I've gotta stop for the bathroom." And I'd kind of look to my mother for some help, and he'd say, "Can't stop." Finally, he'd say, "All right," begrudgingly, "look for a bathroom." So, man, I was casting out there. Whiting's Last Chance Gas, Albuquerque, a million miles away, a zoo with dead coyotes and a blind snake out there. No bathrooms. Finally, I'd see a gas station on the other side of the street. I said, "There's one." He'd say, "It's the wrong side. Shoot, keep going." So I was like white knuckle time all the way. And of course, coming back from St. Louis, the bathroom was always on the other side. So it was bad. So that's the way I traveled. So when I was back in the Midwest, and lunchtime was even better, because my father, I said, being very frugal, tight, he would say, "Woman, get lunch." He always spoke little Hemingway sentences to her, subject verb, and she seemed to respond to that. I didn't know her name was Mildred until I was 15. And, she would go to a little grocery store and come back with a loaf of bread and a package of bologna. And Dad was his concrete shoulders over that wheel, and the dogs drooling and do laps all over me. And she would roll, take a piece of white bread, take a piece of bologna, another piece of white bread, roll it up, hand it to him. He'd lay out this big hand, she'd slap it in there like a surgeon, and in it would go. And he'd say, "See what the boy will have." There was no menu. I don't know why he would ask that question. But it was just the sandwiches. She would pass one by, and I can't stand bologna sandwiches. So I'd stare at it just for a second, and one or two of the dogs would grab it like that, and they would munch it down, and they would throw up or pee in the car. It was not your best traveling condition. But that's the way we did it. So when I was back there by myself, and I was lost trying to find back to Northfield, I remember arriving in Forest City, that little college town, and nobody knew I was coming. Somehow the bookings had fouled up and they didn't know a poet was in town. And somebody met me. I was standing there with my briefcase, and somebody said, "Are you looking for somebody? Do you have some brochures to hand out?" And I said, "No, I'm supposed to read poems." They said, "Well, we don't know about any poems." I said, "Great." They said, "Well, why don't you come down to the chapel with us?" And I walked down to the chapel in the town, where I remember a girl, one of the students there, was giving a talk on how she would not kiss on the first date. And that I stood through that, and said, "Well, I'm proud of you." Back, I got in the car, on the way back to St. Olaf, and I saw this Bright Spot Cafe on the left. And I was hungry, I wanted a cup of coffee, and I could barely turn that car, because my upbringing said, "You get down that line." And I said, "Dad, wherever you are, I'm turning this baby right over there." And it led to the poem. I wanted to give you that by way of background. All right, it's called Bright Spot Cafe. The sign read, "Eat." In a soft April rain, I pulled across the graveled White Rock Road. "Use other door." But there wasn't but one door. While inside, the old-timers laughed and pointed at my fumbling. Inside, into a quiet table, and the waitress, "Bring me a cheeseburger and coffee." "Want the cottage cheese?" "No, just the cheeseburger and coffee." "Don't you want the cottage cheese?" "No, just, how about them French fries?" She stood a while as I studied the tablecloth, then sidled over to the window and gave my order. "And he don't want the cottage cheese." Such a hush then. The ramrod-backed farmers turned on their stools to gape my way. I flushed hot and studied the mysteries of my menu that showed the map of Iowa, saying, "You are here, Dubuque is." and finally to look up at all the eating faces, all engrossed in their cottage cheese. The man across the aisle shoveling it in while his mother gave him what for with each mouthful. I say no mutton chops. Mustache okay, but them chops point to your nose, Roger. And words trailing off to a table next to mine. Dewey's is the best. There's a new man there who lays them out so natural you wouldn't believe it. And he's reasonable. $74, get your casket, wreath of forget-me-nots, and an ad in the Advocate. And that new man lays them out so natural. And finally, my cheeseburger. Small, rounded, cheese unmelted. I look in vain for onion, pickle, lettuce. And the hovering waitress, noticing my hesitation. Now you want your cottage cheese? And silence again in the Bright Spot Cafe as chrome stools turn, farmers look, and conversations hang suspended in beatific silence. Yes, I say. And Iowa resumes its humanistic center of the universe as heresies and dreams alike are laid to rest, looking very natural. So you never know what's going to lead to a poem. Sometimes when you least expect it.
When you write these poems, are they done relatively quickly?
Can we go?
Some come that way, blessedly quickly, some don't. Some take a lot of rewriting and a lot of work, and it's sort of a mixture. Some come faster than you might think they do. I never tell my students in creative writing that, though. I just, you know, I tell them blood, sweat, and tears is the only way to do it. But occasionally one will sneak out pretty fast. One of the last poems, well, maybe if I got here I'll read it, it's called Blue Suit. It's different from, it's not Midwestern or pastoral, but if you'd like to hear it, just to give you an idea that one came very quickly. A girl was giving a report on Wordsworth in my last class this summer, or in the spring, and it was a very tedious report, and the poor girl was laboring, and she was quoting and orating and going on, and I'd given her a C already. And I thought, I'll just give her the C and try not to listen to the rest. And I started writing, because she said Wordsworth was a very dignified person, and he wore a suit. And I wonder who could care whether he wore a suit or not, but I wrote, wore a suit. I started writing when she said, and I put blue suit. And then I wrote the poem, looking at her, smiling a little, probably, and I wrote the poem. Halfway through her report, she started quoting lines from Ode on Intimations of Immortality. The line is, there hath passed away a glory from the earth. And when she said that, I just wrote it, there hath passed away, I'm going to put it right in this poem. So as a, by way of example, here's a poem that came out in her report. Okay. Blue suit. There's something fine about a blue suit, something serious. And a white shirt that must be there, and maybe wingtips at the other end. It almost walks by itself. Down the hardened stones of First Baptist Church, clearing the pavement of the common, the apex of the proud parishioners, or from the local club where lady it sat against the wood and leather of respectability. Again, home to children, all but numb with expectation of its coming. The mother-wife, starched and silent, happy in her mother's eyes, who has one too. Though there hath passed away a glory from the earth, and future Kaisers raise armies on the Rhine, there is this hope. This proof against the storm, waiting in a million darkened closets, ready to go among the mob on serious men. Now that came very, very quickly. So you never know or where they're going to come from. She probably would not have appreciated it if I told her I was writing a poem by listening to her. I was taking notes on her talk. She did all right. Anything else by way of conversation before I read anything?
What about this? Use of time, discipline your time to have time to write.
Oh, I don't have any discipline. Would that I did. A friend of mine, Greg Kuzma, who writes out of the University of Nebraska, publishes a ton of stuff. And once I said, Greg, what's your schedule? He says, you really want to know? As if it's a big secret. I said, yeah, may I? He says, I'll tell you. But you got to promise you're going to do it. I said, all right, I'll try it. He said, 11 o'clock when the kids are asleep and the cat's out, and I go up to my study, I sit down, I open my ledger. At precisely 11 o'clock, I pick up my pen, and I write till 1:30 in the morning, 7 days a week. I said, gee, is that what you do? All right. So I went back to Seward that night and put the kids to bed and got the cat out, and Dolores went to sleep, and I went up to my little trundle room up there and opened, and I got out my ledger and I looked at my watch. I was so excited about this. And I picked up my pen at 11 o'clock and my head hit the desk. And I woke up at 1:30 with a stiff neck. I never tried it since. It worked for him, but it would not work for me. But I write when I can. As you know, as a teacher, a full-time teacher, you just never. In many ways, teaching is the death of a creative writer. In some ways, I think that's been overdone. It's probably a crutch if you take it too seriously. But you find if you teach creative writing, as I do for the last 20 years or so, you give an awful lot of energies to students, and you take a lot of time helping them rewrite when you could be doing your own. So it's a trade-off, I guess.
Out of that, have you had any students who have become writers?
A couple, yeah, a couple. Maybe more that I don't know about, but a couple, a girl and a guy, went on to MFA programs, and they're publishing some things. Okay, here's a poem called Going Back, and sabbatical, in 81, I took a sabbatical. We were up here for part of the fall, and then the last 6 or 8 weeks we were with my father in Illinois on the farm, once again searching for Thomas Wolfe. And, I'm going to back up just before I read that. While I was back there, I got a letter from a student, and I had in class, some girl said, Dear Dr. Ledbetter, would you please send me a copy of that woman's poem that we read in class? Yours truly. I had no idea what woman she was talking about, which poem, which class. I didn't remember the student. And there she was, somehow ferreted me out in Greenville, Illinois. I don't know how. She knew where I was. And she wants me to send her the poem because she needed it for a class that she had in women in literature, and she wanted a woman's poem. What do you do? Greenville, Illinois is not very excited about women poets, anyway, or poets. So I didn't want to disappoint this student, so I thought, well, I'll write some. So I wrote 6 poems, and I sent them to her, and I said, I couldn't find whoever you're looking for, but here's a Southern Illinois woman poet who's very big back here. Her name is, I thought, was it? Carlinda Maines McCormick. That's an interesting name. I sent her these 6 poems. She was delighted to get them. She went to class and she had to give a report on some contemporary woman poet. She says, my report is on Carlinda Maines McCormick. And the teacher, one of my colleagues, Jan Bowman, said, never heard of her, go ahead. So the girl started reading and Jan said, wait a minute, that sounds like Ledbetter. She says, where did you get the poems? And the girl said, I've been had. So I fooled the girl but not the teacher. But anyway, it led to the poems. I'll share them with you, okay? This is there are 6, I'll probably say 3 or 4. This is one, Carlinda's song. Go to town, brother said. They didn't wait to see if she would or not. They just got in the Chevy and drove off down the lane toward town. If Havoke don't want you, to hell with him, John said. And I knew John was sleeping with Willa Koenig, but how could I tell him gathering the eggs and cleaning the old house was not enough? The car turned onto the hard road, and Trix barked twice and curled up beneath the soft maples near the barn. Thunder rolled through the Union Grove Cemetery and left echoes rumbling and rolling along the river bottom. The calves hung their heads and rolled their eyes. The water in the ruts turned black and the woods grew dark and heavy. I don't know where Bobby Havoke is. I hope he's dead. Maybe he's thinking of me. The big car rolled into the lane, scattering the pea gravel. We ate everything but the squeal. You should have come. The rain came suddenly, chasing the ducks beneath the barn. She stood a while on the porch, rubbing one hand up and down on her arm. She stood before the oak mirror. Outside, her brothers laughed and swung hedge posts at rats piling out of the chicken house. Bobby Havoke waited with one foot on his pickup. She looked down at the steaming ground and ran her hand over her chest, turned sideways to the mirror and felt her stomach. She knew her mother's portrait was in the big trunk, but she didn't look at it. Through the tinted glass, which Chet Shank said was worth something, Bobby Havoke looked long and lean. She watched him lay over the hood of the pickup, stretching across the hot metal where his thin bones would feel the heat of the motor. Okay, now I'm going to skip to the last one, Carlinda's song. Bye. My aunt said it was going to rain, so we had all better plan to stay to supper. The clouds gathered quickly, and the barn was lost in the darkness. The cows beside the gate lowered their heads and waited for someone to let them in the barn. The geese, who had lain all day like a cotton blanket on the green grass, scuttled hoarsely under the house. Children down the road at the birthday party for Mrs. Dewey from the home lost their balloons in the gusts of wind that sent them high into the dark clouds. Finally, my uncle, who had hogs to feed, got up and put on his coat. The minister looked up at him. The little girls down the road were specks of color on the horizon, where they would be putting Mrs. Dewey back into the car to take her back to the home in time for her lunch. The balloons long since lost over stubbled corn and milo fields. So Carlinda took us to the barn and said she would read ghost stories to us, and that the kids down at the party lost their balloons anyway and would not get to hear any ghost stories. The pickup bounced over the flower bed and stopped beside the barn. Carlinda saw it and was very quiet. When Bobby Havoke got out, he carried his gun over his shoulder. I wanted to go with him if he was going for rabbits, and said I was going to go, but Carlinda said, "Shh, let's hide from him. That'll be fun." So we scoured down into the straw and waited for Bobby Havoke to find us. And Carlinda said she would go give him some hints about where we were, and she would come back, and we should stay hid and be quiet, or the game would be over and we would have to go in. We waited in the warm straw, waited for Bobby Havoke to find us, but he didn't find us. And Carlinda didn't come back to tell us ghost stories, but we heard them laugh once before it rained. And then we couldn't see the house or the cows beside the gate, and the rain hit the slanting tin roof of the barn above us, and we waited in the warm straw and dreamed the balloons were sailing over our barn, bright colors, round glossy balloons, bright in the dark rain, finding our barn even though the cows couldn't find it, hovering rounded globes of colors, pointing to where we lay beneath the warm straw in the dark and secret barn. So, without belaboring the point, you never know where the poems are going to come from. I'm trying to help this girl out. I wound up giving her a bad time, but I got some poems, so worked out.
This may be too hard a question, but what's the key to write a free verse?
Probably no key. In some ways, without being gross here, Hemingway said you have to have a built-in shit detector. You have to be able to, something has to click inside, and you have to know when to start and when to stop. And with a sonnet, of course, you're writing ba-bum, 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 you've got five beats and 14 lines and a certain rhyme scheme, and it's all laid out. And it just takes hard work, and you can get that form. Free verse, who knows when you do this, and line here and a little bitty line there, or E.E. Cummings hopping all over. There's no key, I think. I think free verse is a freeing kind of a thing. I think it's easier to write narrative, a story type, poems with story lines in them with free verse. That's probably not, in fact, true, because obviously people like Shakespeare and Pope and Wordsworth did fine Frost with the sonnet form, and never was any constraint for them. I guess if you've got the talent, you can write anything in any form. But I find free verse just freer. Sounds like a circular definition. But there's no key. Not that I know of.
Really, what's the difference between free verse and ultra short story?
And a what short story?
A very short story.
Yeah. Oh. fair enough question. It would have to be a bloody short story. I mean, very, very short story. I guess a short story. Even a short story would probably not have the same sense of compression and heightened sense of emotion that a poem probably ought to have. That's not to say you shouldn't have those kinds of things in a short story. The best literature always has. The best writers for me are really very poetic. Thomas Wolfe, for example, Faulkner is just poetic as can be. And Tolstoy and some of his sections are just dynamite. They're poems, but you can't sustain that over 1,000 pages of War and Peace. So I think a poem is like a rubber band. You pick up a rubber band and stretch it, you can thrum it, it's got its tension. A fiction, I think you can afford to bring it together and let it droop once in a while and waste a few 100,000 words once in a while. That's probably a poor answer, but I just don't have a better one, I guess.
You have mentioned poetic, using the very different senses. Define what's poetic. You're saying so-and-so wrote poetically or whatever. What does that mean?
All these good questions. Well, example that just came to mind is Faulkner, who's my favorite American novelist, in his trilogy, The Hamlet, The Mansion, The Town. He's talking about the Snopes, the poor white trash out of Mississippi. And these guys are really bad news ghoul type people. And one of the Snopes is not quite there. And we've got one Orton Water. And he loves to go around behind the feedlot and look at the cow. He's fallen in love, literally, with this cow. And he's always taking out this little knot hole and watching the cow. And then he slips in there and puts his arm around the cow and makes little mewling noises and kind of caresses the cow. And all the good old boys sitting out there whittling on the stoop say, "Hey, old crazy's doing it again." So they go around and they watch him do the same, you know, and take bets on what he's going to do to the cow. And so finally the crazy guy leads the cow out into the wilderness, out into the bayou country. And Faulkner has the most brilliant description of this idiot and the cow walking into the sunset. He doesn't understand anything. He's very dense. They come to a pond, he doesn't understand why, he sees a reflection, he walks in, almost drowns. The cow finally gets out, he picks beautiful flowers and makes a garland, puts them around her neck, and sleeps with his head against her flank all night. A gorgeous description, and when you're through, you think, now I'm reading about a nut making love to a cow, or you know, embracing his cow. What a horrible idea, and yet Faulkner treats it so delicately and beautifully, just sheer poetry. Another bad answer to your question, I guess. It should have some kind of impression, I guess, a sense of metaphor. And it reading the meter again. Okay, this is going back. The poem I talked about is in five sections, right? With my father in sabbatical. Going back is hard. Better not try, I think, though now it's too late. What are those trees rising out of the river? My father points to them. He planted them, he says, 50 years ago when I was nearly drowned by the levee. I don't look at him. His voice is odd, as if the trees had dripped pollen into his eyes, and the sunset over the river had streaked his face with those Midwest colors of early autumn he wanted me to see. I'm trying to see how it must have been, as he points to the birds rising, spiraling above the water, flecking rust on the huge sun sinking behind the slag heaps. He tells me to zip my coat against the wind. My God, I'm 47 years old. I zip my coat, and he sniffs, looks skyward, and wrinkles his forehead as if fixing the sight, just this sight, when we walked to the river, and he asked me if I was going to be a good boy or should he take back the Christmas presents already stacked beneath the tree. My stomach knots now, too late to save the emptiness we had together then, when I knew he would not take the presents away, yet could not stop the spread of fear that has lasted all these years, apart from the changing sky, the bristling wind, and his heavy hand. We walked silently through the gardens next to the house we once lived in. Now it is vacant, having burned down twice before, but we walk among the ruins, building it all over again. My father walks away from me. He stops beside the levee, watching the water run over the sandy bottom where our lines must have trailed before fires found the house and ate the morning glory trellis he placed there the summer I was four. A token, he called it. The sounds at night are muffled by the river flowing evenly behind the levee. An old phonograph record plays from the parlor, the curtains billow into the room. Soon the cicadas will sing in the soft maples beside the road because it will rain later. My father saw the signs, he said, and says rain. He wants to fix the swing on the old porch so we can have talks. He says he wants to talk. The calendar in my room has no February. Rain. He sits in the backyard watching the water. We don't call him in for supper. He says it will rain again and wants to watch for ducks on the river. The wind is coming up and the maples turn away from the wind, their leaves silver in the dusky light. He sits down there in the yard, hunched over the little table he built for me when we played picnic, and he brought the tea to me in the red wagon. I don't know what happened to the red wagon. It might have been burned in the fire that took the house. And he won't come in, though it has started to sprinkle just like he said it would. His coat is skimpy. The curtains flow into my room and hide him. The river has turned dark and the trees sough strangely in the wind off the water. My God, how long will he stay out there? Soon someone will open the screen door to tell him I've gone. And the curtains upstairs will stir as they did in all those red days, arched in a kind of forever against the yellow grain frying in the sun. Thunder. and a little cool air at the closing of the door. So, those are some new poems I wanted to share with you.
It's the basis of that as compared to your description of your father's travel in the car.
I'm not sure I can answer that one. That's multifaceted. I don't know.
Well, from what you said about the travels across the country.
Yeah.
And he's short speaking and then talking about this very emotional person. Maybe I guess what I'm questioning is this personal interaction, father or an imagined?
No, it's very real. Part of it, some of it's imagined, I'm sure, and embellished by the subconscious, but most of it's right on. Maybe I ought to tell the story that Harry asked for, just to maybe give you some background of how I was raised. Some of you are maybe from the farm, but I've asked that before, and even farm people say, I don't know where you're from, but those are my
parents. We didn't do it that way.
No. I was raised on a farm with three little houses on it, and my grandmother was the matriarch of the clan, and my uncles all lived on the farm, and I grew up with my cousin, sort of wild Indian people. They always scared the hell out of us constantly, kept us in a sort of fear all the time, like saying, if you don't do your chores, if you don't do something right, God knows what's going to happen to you. And I'd say, oh, what's going to happen? And they'd always scare us like that. I can remember vividly sitting out under the maples in a swing with my grandmother. She'd always tell us ghost stories, which really put an edge on it anyway. Always at night, always in the summertime, and Bill and I huddled there. And she was telling ghost stories, and this white-sheeted character would jump out of the bushes next to the swing and grab Bill and run down the lane with him. I said, my God, Granny, the ghost has got Billy, stop him. And then this thing would stop and whip off the sheet, and it would be my uncle, Billy's father. And my father would jump out of the bushes next to him and say, well, we got him that time, didn't we, Luke? We sure did, George, and off they'd run laughing. And Bill has collapsed, I was wetting my britches, and my grandmother just kind of rocking beatifically, saying, now the next story, if you're good boys and girls. So then Bill and I would sleep with Granny. She said, if you're good, well, I'll tell you ghost stories tonight. And we didn't know if we wanted it or not, you know. So we'd be getting undressed, and all of a sudden a face would come up the window and go, like that, the window. And God, I'd drop again and wet my pantaloons one more time. And I'd look out the window, and there'd go Bill and, my Uncle Lute and my dad across the lawn, slapping each other in the back. We got him that time, that was it. Well, this went on all the time. Occasionally, we'd go for rides in the country. We never wanted to, but they would force us in the back seats. We had our little cars running around, making the noises, never paying attention to the adults, until finally I hear my mother saying, do you think she'll be out tonight? And my dad would say, I hope not. And boy, the cars came to a stop. Bill and I looked at each other and kind of came up over the seat. Who's going to be out tonight? My dad even started to look at this guy and he'd say, you know, she always wears black, and she stood right there at that old maple tree last time. Remember when those hitchhikers were never heard from again? Down we went. Well, every night, you know, we'd have something like that going on. The apex of this was always at Christmas, when about a week before Christmas, my uncle would come out and say, are you kids doing your chores right? I said, yes, Uncle Luke. He said, did you slop the hogs? Did you really put it in the trough, or did you just throw it out on the ground? Which, of course, we had. Hogs could care less. And we said, where do we put it in the trough? I said, why? He said, because Claus is coming. Claus knows what you're doing. I said, Claus is coming. What could that be? And every day for a week before Christmas, it was Claus something. Till finally on the day of Christmas Eve, my grandmother opened this big room about this size where all the furniture was drop claws and nobody ever went into unless somebody was born there or died there. I was born there on a Christmas Eve, on a Christmas day. Once I remember the Baptist minister came there and they had some sort of lemonade and my aunt fainted and it was all hush hush. I don't know exactly what happened to my aunt and minister, but it was back somewhere in Memphis. But we got let into this room on Christmas Eve because all my aunts and uncles and everybody would arrive in the reunion. They would be playing euchre, an old card game, and smoking cigars that were unaccustomed. My father would always get sick and they always dumb games. My cousin and I were under the table with our cars again. Until finally Luther said, boy, you boys better be good because Claus is coming tonight. Just then I hear this boom, 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 boom on the door. I hear sleigh bells. And my uncle would always look at us, and I kept, why are you looking at us all the time? He'd say, that's Claus. Oh, God, here, don't wet your pants and disgrace yourself again. And my uncle would walk to the door, and he'd grab, I remember that porcelain doorknob, which when nobody was looking, I used to go lick, which drove my father crazy. He said, what are you licking that damn knob like a cowboy? And my uncle would open that door, and there would stand Santa Claus, 9 feet tall, 500 pounds, with a Santa Claus suit, his beard flowing in the snow coming in on the ground, and he would walk in with a sack of toys over us, and he had a corn knife in his hand, and he would throw those things on the ground, and in a big voice he said, "Where are the little bastards?" And Bill and I figured that was us. We were the only little bastards in the room, as far as I knew. He said, "Where are those cutthroats?" And he would see us under the table, and he would come real close to that corn knife and say, "You little devils." And I was just, "Bill!" And then he would proceed to call up every member of our family and say, he always knew something about the members, like, "Leslie Ledbetter, didn't I see you down at the gas station talk to the widow Douglas last night? Weren't you down there? You devil, you." And he would hand him a toy. He would call up my aunt and have some odd thing. I used to think, how does Claus know all this stuff? You know, I must have a very wicked family because they're all in big trouble. And he'd give all the toys away. He finally got to the last two and he'd say, "Billy Ledbetter." And my cousin would try to shove me out. And I said, "No, I'm Jack. I knew better than that one." So Bill would go up there and he would get his, and it's always last because I was a little one. I'd go up my little short pants. He'd say, "Jackie Ledbetter." And I'd waddle up there and say, "Don't wet, don't wet, don't wet." He'd look over and he'd say, "In that corn knife," he'd say, "Can you say a piece?" I'd say, "No, no, Claus. What'd you call me?" "No, Santa Claus." He said, "Can you sing a song?" I said, "No, Claus." He said, "Can you do anything?" I said, "No, nothing." He said, "What good are you?" "No, nothing at all. No good at all. No good." And he'd hand me my toy and turn me around, bend me over, kick me in the butt, and sprawling back under the table. And with that, he'd pick up the empty sack, walk to the door, fling open the door, and the snow would blow again. And on the way out, he'd pause and take that corn knife and stick it right down under the table and say, "You little bastards." And slam the door. And that was Christmas. And everybody went back to their playing euchre, while passing the food, and Bill and I were absolutely collapsed.
How old were you at this time?
Probably 4, 5, 6.
How's Bill these days?
Crazy as a pet coon. No, he's fine. Yeah. I just told you that story because you asked for it, because it gives you an idea of the love-hate edge that we walked on. For years, I had dreams and nightmares. For years, even into a teenager, I would dream of going out on a farm and opening some outbuilding, like an outhouse or a tool shed or the barn, and in there would be Claus standing there looking down at me with that corn knife. I dreamed that for years.
Tremble whenever you see pictures of St. Nicholas.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that little boys and girls sang songs of baby Jesus and had a nice time until I was in the teenage years. I thought everybody suffered. In retrospect, when we went back, when I took my kids when they were small back to Illinois for Christmas, my cousin, I had two cousins, Bill and Jim, and Jim was always the oldest. In fact, it was he, we were playing around one day when I was older, I don't know, 10 or so, and we were in a part of the house where we were not supposed to be in, my aunt's bedroom, and Jim said, "Hey, Bill, Jack, come here, look at this." And we rushed in there, and there on the bed lay the Santa Claus suit, and it was my Uncle Lewis. And it was a great revelation for me. I've been had all these years, scared of my uncle. Well, I was scared of him anyway, in or out of the suit. So when I took my kids back, Jim said, "Hey, want to do Claus?" I said, "No way, no way. Not with my kids, you don't." I would have taken him away from there and headed back to California had he done that, but he was just razzing me. In retrospect, it has become myth again. It's part of my, you know, the fabric of myth, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. On the other hand, it has left probably some psychic scars that are that show up once in a while in different ways. There's no doubt about that.
What I was impressed with was what you just stated about the love-hate dichotomy, which I think is not unique to your
sure.
experience, but it's kind of an age experience.
Sure.
Or
yeah.
You know, fathers or
yeah.
Males at one time. Wanting to express certain things, but unable to, and that's always
very likely
going back and forth.
Very likely. I remember the first time I read *Fathers and Sons* by Turgenev. I was stunned by what was going on in that novel. I thought, I've been through that. Some of it. What time do you have? I got to let you go in a second. Just about. We got time for one more.
About 3 or 4 minutes.
3 or 4 minutes. How about a quick one? The last three poems I wrote just before I came up here. It's called *Not Like Iowa*. Fall this year will be late, I suspect. The barrancas are so dry now you can't imagine water running over the old cracks or whirling around the oak roots that bite into the clay cliffs. Still, someone will probably smell rain, they'll say. Oh, not like Iowa, of course. Okay, and then I'll let you go. It's called Summer. Where does it say August nights have to be so hot? The old dog hears me and thumps her tail on the floor. If I look at her, I'll have to get right down there with her. The kid across the street has just about mastered the drums. Just about. And tonight, on our walk, I wondered at the cool breeze I felt when we turned at those big poplars. No doubt it's hot in Illinois, too. My dad will be dozing in his chair, the farm dazzling in moonlight. You've been a good audience, thank you. How's that?